This is the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000.
All right, let's talk.
Enjoy the best of today's show. Here's Adam Gold.
It's actually not the reason I drank. I was already drinking as I was watching NC State lose to Oklahoma State 72-66. Did you watch any of this game last night, Alec? Wolfpack played Oklahoma State. It was in the, the tip-off something at Mohegan Sun in Connecticut.
Did not watch last night.
So I don't know why. I'm hoping there was basically nobody there because of COVID limitations. Hoping. But if we're being honest, so many of these early season neutral court non-conference basketball events just don't get fan attendance. Like maybe, I don't know, the 1,000 people who are State fans here will fly up for the game maybe, or you'll get a few people who happen to live in the New York area who are willing to drive up to Uncasville, Connecticut to go see it. But there was like nobody there. It's kind of disappointing. State went scoreless over the last 3.5 minutes or so of the first half. Got worse over the first 2/3 of the second half. But they rallied. They made it a game. They got it to one possession. But ultimately, Oklahoma State hit a bunch of free throws down the stretch. NC State only stayed in the game because they hit, 24 of 26 free throws in the second half. It was like a professional free throw shooting clinic. I think Jericho Helms was 10 of 10. Darian Sebron was 7 of 9 from the free throw line. No Manny Bates is a big deal. And we all understand that. Manny Bates not being there at both ends of the court is a big deal. They don't have a replacement for Manny Bates. So everybody else is really going to have to elevate their level of play. And you're not going to compensate for a player like that. You know, they've got some guys who can kind of step in and be not a reasonable facsimile thereof, but can pick up a little bit of the slack, but not much. They just don't have a ton. So this is going to have to be a team that beats you with quickness and pressure defense. And that really wasn't there. When they had their opportunities to really... where they were impacting the game positively, they just didn't get enough out of it. Like, they had a lead. Oklahoma State only had, like, 6 points in the first 10 minutes. But, you know, State only had, like, 15. When you are controlling the game, you got to do more with it. And, like I mentioned, Darian Sebron. Sebron's been awesome. He is an impact player. Both ends of the floor, handles the ball a lot. Yeah, I mean, I think what is this, third double-double of the season? First time in the last 4 games he didn't set a personal best in terms of, points, in terms of scoring. But they need more out of Cam Hayes. They need Jericho Helms to step, take his game to another level. Terquavion Smith only played like 15 minutes last night. So they're going to need a bunch. They might not be equipped. I don't know. You know there are good players there. Do they have enough of them to crank up defensive pressure, get easy baskets, and then when they turn it over, and they turned it over 17 times last night, it's just hard. You're giving away easy buckets. They got outscored off the bench, and they don't have a very deep bench, but Oklahoma State outscored them by over 50 points coming off the bench last night. It's hard. That's hard to overcome when the other team is bringing 56 points off the bench. They're starting 5 guys, but getting 56 points off the bench. So we'll talk to Brian Geisinger about that in a little bit. But it was a little discouraging to watch that the end of the first half and a good chunk of the second half. Then they came back in the game. They don't seem to have a great three-point presence. They need more of that. They're going to have to play small ball to win, and I'm not sure that they're good enough on the perimeter to do that. All right, the Carolina Panthers, Alec, are 5-5. A perfectly mediocre football outfit in the middle of a perfectly mediocre grouping of teams that are trying to squeeze into the last two playoff spots in the NFC. To illustrate that point, the Saints are 5-4. They have Trevor Siemian as their quarterback, although we did have Taysom Hill. Taysom Hill came in and played. Carolina's 5-5. Those are the sixth and seventh seeds right now in the NFC. Right behind Carolina, 4-5 Minnesota. They host the Packers this week. San Francisco also 4-5. Atlanta 4-5. Philadelphia 4-6. All of these teams, theoretically, with chances to make the playoffs, because, I mean, it might just be 9-8 that makes the playoffs. Anyway, Minnesota, Atlanta, and Philadelphia all have one thing in common. Do you know what that is, Alec? All three of those teams beat Carolina. Yeah, it's not good.
No.
No bueno.
Losing stinks.
Yeah. So, the Panthers are just part of that pulp in the NFC. But they do have one thing that none of those teams have. They have Cam Newton. And I'm not even getting into Cam Newton, the player, just yet. Because ESPN has probably talked more about the Panthers this week than they have any other team in the NFL. More than the Packers, who have the best record in the NFC. More than the Titans, who have the best record in the AFC. More than the Cowboys, who might be the best team in the NFL. I don't know. Why? Why do you think that? We all know why. Cam Newton. Keyshawn Johnson from Keyshawn, J. Will, and Max this morning. He is confident in Cam's impact.
Well, you got to think, they're sitting in 7 right now, they're 5-5, right? You look at what's coming in front of Washington without Chase Young. You know Cam's going to be fired up to play against his old coach. They get Christian McCaffrey. He's in the backfield. You say, okay, I'm going to give them that W. Then you start to say, what's next? The Miami Dolphins. I'm going to give them that W. Then you say there's Atlanta. So now that's 3 in a row with Cam there. So now you're sitting at 8-5. And you got the Buccaneers twice. You still got the New Orleans Saints to come. So it's kind of like you start counting these wins up and you start saying to yourself, they may not win the division or they may win the division. And if they do, ooh-wee, just imagine what people would say about Cam Newton at that point in time. But they certainly could find themselves in a wild card spot.
I think Keyshawn needs a spiced maple bourbon fizz.
I do find myself a little uncomfortable with the Cam hype.
Well,
and not because of Cam the person,
right,
or the energy or
true
anything, but it feels as though suddenly we all just believe that the Panthers are this great football team because of him.
What will it say about the NFL if Cam Newton, I mean, is great over the last 7 weeks of the season? What will that say about the NFL? There's a lot of teams out there that have bad quarterback play.
Mm-hmm.
Bad quarterback play. That would be an indictment on the NFL. That they allowed a player like that to just sit around and, I don't know, whatever Cam was doing for 9 weeks, 10 weeks from the time he was released by the Patriots. I guess until the time he got vaccinated.
Yeah, but I guess it says something about him, but there really hasn't been a ton of reason to believe that Cam Newton is going to be a great player.
Except that he had a good preseason. He was good with the Patriots.
But that's the preseason, and people have a tough time using that as the barometer to gauge whether or not you're going to be good in the regular season.
Right, but if you have quarterback needs, so the Miami Dolphins theoretically might have quarterback needs. But by the way, they're now completely back on the Tua's our guy train. They're back on that, even though he didn't start the other game and they started Jacoby Brissett. And, you know, New Orleans needed a quarterback.
Right.
Right, when Jameis Winston got hurt a few weeks ago. Houston has needed a quarterback all year. Right? They were Deshaun Watson was never playing.
Yeah, no.
And then Tyrod Taylor got hurt, and they were resigned to the Davis Mills experience.
No, so, I understand that. I'm just saying that if you were signing Cam Newton, you were basically signing him in hopes that he would be good.
Right.
And hope ain't a strategy.
No, I understand that. But the only thing you have to base what you saw from Cam was that he actually was good in the visible moments you could see from the preseason. So there's no reason to not bring him in. If you are the Houston Texans, there was no reason to not bring him in. Miami was holding out hope that something would happen with Deshaun Watson, right? There was no reason that they couldn't have assessed that, all right, this is not going to happen this year. We think we have a pretty good team. Let's not mess around with a pretty good team with poor quarterback play. Let's bring him in, right? I'm not sitting. Look, I wasn't sure anyway, but it's not my job to know. It's their job to be able to look around and see, who could help us win?
And when you have quarterback play like that, you don't. There's really nothing to lose,
right? What are they? I mean, look where the Dolphins are.
Yeah,
the Dolphins are what, 3-3 this season? They're going to win this weekend, by the way, because the Jets are sending Joe Flacco out to play against the Miami Dolphins.
I mean, I think Jacoby Brissett's a viable backup quarterback.
He is. As it turns out, I mean, Jacoby's just not a starter, I guess. I think he's somebody who can give you one or two good games, but ultimately he's just okay. And just okay, unless the rest of your team is great, isn't going to get it done. And you saw how quickly the Colts moved on from him. I mean, he looked okay 2 years ago, and then they had a chance to get Phillip Rivers. Went, we're getting Phillip Rivers. Jacoby Brissett's going to be our backup. And then they didn't even have Phillip Rivers, and they went, yeah, we're going to get Carson Wentz, who I don't think is dramatically better than Jacoby Brissett, to be perfectly honest. But they do.
Yeah.
So, and they're smarter about this than I am. I promise you that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've been on the record saying that I think that Cam Newton at this point in his career is closer to a backup quarterback or a backup quarterback than he is anything else. So, you know, I hope I'm wrong, honestly. I hope that Cam Newton is great for Carolina. I hope he leads them to a playoff run or whatever. But I think I need more time, and so I'm a little uncomfortable with all of the, you know, basically it feels like all the problems are gone now with Cam Newton.
Well, I think you have a chance to be way more right than wrong here. All we saw last week was short yardage Cam, right? That's all we saw last week.
Right.
So we don't know what Cam we're going to
have. The league hasn't beaten Cam before. It's not like they haven't mitigated Cam before.
They've beaten healthy Cam before. So there's a lot. Like, it's funny to me. The Panthers are still who they are. They still have a trash offensive line. They still have mediocre, you know, receiving targets. You know, mediocre is probably not the right. Mediocre sounds negative. They have middle of the pack receiving targets. Doesn't that sound better than mediocre?
Yes, it
does. Does so they have
average
receiving targets. They have an elite running back, right? They have an elite running back in Christian McCaffrey. But we have no idea whether or not their offense will be like really good just because you have inserted Cam Newton, because we haven't seen Cam play in this system just yet. My guess is that they'll be more run oriented, which is actually good for everything, good for the defense, good for their offense as well. And they won't have to generate 30 points a game in order to win, where they can win a lot of games like 20-17 that range. Right? And that's fine.
I think that's what Matt Rhule wants to do. I mean, I think that in his mind, when he said earlier this year, we want to run the ball more.
Right.
To me, that's playing to your defensive strengths it's mitigating your offensive line problems, and that's kind of what I was getting at when I was defending that logic earlier in the season.
Right.
I mean, I understood your point in the sense that they just can't. They was thinking under the philosophy and the ability are two separate things.
Right. It's,
right.
It's the old you go to war. I hate to use war analogies. You go to war with the army you have, not the army you want.
Right. Right. Exactly. So
they have more of an army to do that now.
Now they do, yes.
Even though the offensive line is still trash.
Yes, yes. So I agree. I think that it's a perfect formula for them if they can pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if they can pull it off.
Yeah. Look, I think this week is a problem. I think Washington's going to be difficult.
And really, if we're being honest about Cam's career, it's the way his career should have been. And was, in large part, played out while he was in his prime, was behind his running ability and utilizing the running game for a time, you know, Jonathan Stewart and Mike Tolbert.
Yeah.
And then Christian McCaffrey later in his time.
We never got Cam. We never got healthy Christian and Cam together, really.
Cam Newton, the thrower, has never really been that great of a thing.
Well, I think you're probably selling it a little short.
I mean, I think there are aspects to his passing game that he does better than others, but as a complete passer, being able to throw the deeps, the intermediates, the shorts, you know, the touch factor for Cam's ball on each one of those things, you know, we're not talking about John Elway here. Like, well, he was a good passer, not a great one.
You know, here's the wild thing is that there's probably a better comparison between Elway and Newton as a thrower than you think. Elway was also a low percentage thrower, but it's primarily because of the types of passes they threw. You know, Cam's in the early part of Cam's career, they threw down the field more than most teams. There weren't a lot of short passes, which is why, like, it was written about in this way as well as you could ever write about it. Would you ever call Steph Curry a poor shooter for shooting 45%?
No.
Of course not, right?
No, because he shoots everything from deep.
Exactly. So when Cam is throwing not the majority of his passes, but a lot more passes than other players, throwing it deeper down the field, which obviously have a more a lower completion rate than guys who throw 2 yards across the line of scrimmage or dump off passes more often, well, then his 59% is a little different than somebody's 69%.
Ah, I totally agree with that.
And that has always been lost. We get fixated on the same stat all the time, completion percentage. So in his last year in 2018, before he got hurt, his completion percentage was at about 68%.
Yeah.
Why? Because he was throwing short.
Short, yes.
Like, it's not that difficult. So he's always had inconsistencies with his mechanics, and that has led to a lot of the inaccuracies. And I expect that that's probably still the same.
Yeah, either way, there's been touch issues for him, there have been inaccuracy issues for him, but the primary strength of his game was always as a running threat.
Mm-hmm.
That opened everything else up for him.
Brian Geisinger, League Pass Lair, accsports.com, at @BGeis_Bird on Twitter. I want to talk about the two state university basketball programs. We watched the Wolfpack last night. They look good, sort of, I guess, for like the first 15 minutes of the game, but they didn't get enough out of it. Thought for, 8 or 9 minutes in, maybe 10 minutes in, when Oklahoma State still only scored 6 points, you only had 15. Maybe that could have been 22, 23, 24. No Manny Bates obviously matters. What has to happen for them to be... I'll just say really good, and then we can all decide what really good means.
Yeah, I'm not sure they can get to really good without Manny Bates. I mean, you and I, we can all pull up the numbers from Bates, and we can see X number of points per game, rebounds per game, and certainly the blocks, right? I mean,
yeah.
2 years ago, he leads the country in block rate. Last year, he was top 10, top 20 in block rate, just an elite rim protector. But those numbers don't happen like in a vacuum, right? Like you, it's not just, oh, can they replace this this many points, this many rebounds, this many blocks, right, from Manny Bates. Because what State does on both sides of the court around the pick and roll is so much of that is contingent on having a really, really productive two-way center. Now, I think when we think about Kevin Keats and NC State, we like to talk small ball, switching, right? They switch 1 through 4. Mm-hmm. They usually, you know, it used to be Torin Dorn playing small ball power forward. Now it's Jericho Helms or Darion Sebron. But that style of play on both ends is dependent on having a center that can both protect the paint and then also be a target slipping and diving to the rim out of pick and roll, because no one in the ACC runs more pick and roll than NC State. But the way they get rim pressure on those looks is Bates screening and rolling hard to the rim. And teams have to respect him when Manny dives to the hoop because he can catch and dunk on mm-hmm. anybody. That opens up players elsewhere on the court. And all of a sudden, Cam Hayes can spray out to Thomas Allen for a three, or Darion Sebron can slash against an open lane. And then defensively, State switches 1 through 4. But if the center is involved in the ball screen, they drop that player and he sits in the lane and he protects the paint. And if anyone gets beat off the dribble, Manny's waiting for them at the rim. So, you know, I just think they lost he's their best player, and he's a hell of a defensive player. And what he does offensively rolling to the rim is really underrated. I worry about State's ability to get rim pressure from anyone that isn't really Darion Sebron this year. Like Cam Hayes is a good player, but he's a pull-up shooter, you right. know, like he doesn't really get downhill. And so Bates was the avenue for that. And so I worry a little bit about like where State's offense is going to pick up. And yeah, last night, it's like, you know, they shot poorly. They turned it over a ton.
Yep.
If they don't get to the free throw line as much and pound the offensive glass, you know, that game probably looks a little bit worse. But like, I just think they're going to have games like that where they take too many pull-up shots and not nearly enough of them go in.
Brian Geisinger is joining us here on the Adam Gold Show. Kevin Keats was able to win a bunch of games. Now, it's UNC Wilmington. Obviously, when you're playing Colonial basketball, it's a little bit different. I don't mean to knock the Colonial. Shouts to you guys at Elon. Hold on one second. You want to scream at me, Alec? Here, go. There we go. I'm not trying. They play good basketball in the Colonial. They always have. So this is not about that. But they were successful even outside of the Colonial. They played a style yeah. which was difficult to match up and deal with because you don't see a ton of it. But I don't know that he's ever really gotten to that here, even with Manny Bates. Was that a team that was going to, you know, play a lot of high tempo pressure ball?
I think that what's unfortunate is, like, I mean, the 2020 tournament getting canceled because of COVID. I think there are a couple coaches in the ACC, Kevin Keats and Chris Mack is who I'm speaking about specifically. I mean, certainly like FSU, you know, they could have maybe won the title that year or whatever. Absolutely. But like guys like Keats and Chris Mack, they came in the ACC 1 year apart, right? Mm-hmm. And both guys have been to the tournament a grand total of both guys have been to the tournament one time, right, each. And so I think both guys are now Chris Mack has far bigger, maybe even some larger issues happening outside of just like what's happening on the court. But I think as the two fan bases are trying to like evaluate where those coaches are, it can get a little tricky because they're saying, well, you're 4 or 5 years in here and only one NCAA tournament appearance. And that's kind of unfair because both those teams would have made the tournament in 2020 and Louisville could have been like a, you know, Sweet 16, Elite Eight team, whatever. You know, I really think some of the best offenses Keats had was probably that first year when they had not Manny Bates, but Amir Yurtseven, yep. who we know as like an NBA type or fringe NBA type center who could really, you know, he can't protect the rim like Manny, but was a really, really good pick and roll weapon in the half court. Not only because he was great rolling to the basket, but Yurtseven could also pick and pop and roll into space. And that's something that Bates can't do. So when teams would take, that was sophomore year Markel Johnson, and when teams would trap Markel or try to ice those side ball screens and keep the ball on one side of the court, Well, Yurtseven would just slip to the middle of the court and bomb a catch and shoot three and just keep it moving. You can sort of gum up NC State's offense, even the last couple of years, when they run pick and roll with Bates and then teams would trap Markell Johnson or trap Devin Daniels because all of a sudden he can't just throw it to the outlet center who can just catch and shoot a three.
Darian Sebring's going to end up being their best player, isn't he?
It looks like. I mean, he's playing incredible basketball. You could see it. You and I talked about it late last season when Daniels went down, and it took them a couple of games to kind of find their footing, but part of that was Sebring turned into one of the top like open court players in the league. And you're seeing it so far. Like, he's been dynamic in transition. He's been dynamic on the offensive glass. Like, he is a big-time grab-and-go weapon. Like, get a rebound, get a loose ball, and he can just take off and push it right away. And, yeah, I mean, he's just having a sensational season. And he can't even – you know, he's not even, like, really shooting the ball from, you know, up from deep that well or anything like that. Like, he's just getting to the rim. So – he's an important player. He's rangy. He's long. He's got ball skills. Like, he's having a hell of a season so far. But, you know, they're going to obviously need more from some of their other perimeter guys if they're going to, like, actually contend in the conference this year.
Yeah, he feels point guardish to me, even though it would be non-traditional. But I feel like he's going to initiate the offense a ton. I'm a huge fan. Let me ask you about the Tar Heels. Two games in a row now, and I'm not even saying lesser competition. I don't want to disparage Brown, who I think is probably pretty good, and College of Charleston, at least in terms of where they are as a basketball program. Again, I think one of those programs that is going to beat people. Heck, didn't they beat the Tar Heels a few years back? So it is certainly that is a program with some winning pedigree. So this is not about that. This is about how the Tar Heels played, I guess, early on in both games. And it is giving people cause for worry. I'm not worried about this team. Is this a situation where they're just trying to figure out how best to gel as a group? Hubert Davis figuring out combinations? I mean, I love so many of the pieces that they've got.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I do too. I think their personnel is really good. I think the pieces fit together pretty well this season, even if you can't have all of these guys on the court at the same time. Like, you can't play Baycott, Manic, and Garcia, but you got a really nice front court rotation with those guys. Yeah. Caleb Love has looked really good to start the season. RJ Davis has looked good to start the season, at least offensively. And Kerwin Walton, like, yeah, man, the guy is, you know, the ACC's Klay Thompson or whatever. Like, he's just an elite wing shooter. Defensively against Brown, you know, didn't look great. It's not that they gave up a lot of threes in terms of volume, but just too many open looks from Brown's pick and pop action. And then, and you also, just side note, you were talking about College of Charleston, like, just give Pat Kelsey a couple of years. Like, he just got done absolutely dominating, just literally pushing people around for a couple of years in the Big South at Winthrop.
Right.
And I would imagine he's going to get this ship up and running at College of Charleston pretty quickly, but just give them a year or two. And then, yeah, I don't know. I just think, like, I would guess they haven't really forced a ton of turnovers defensively. You'd like to see more of that so they can get their great athletes out on the break. Leaky Black has been an important player for them so far in terms of, like, on-off splits so far this season. But yeah, I think it's going to be just using these early games as a bridge to sort of build up and get your rotation. And look, they've got a really hard game this weekend. Like, Purdue is awesome.
Yep.
Purdue has a guy named Jaden Ivey, who's one of the best draft prospects in the country, but they're a complete team. They run great action in the half court. Matt Painter's a good coach. Like, this is going to be a big deal. And they've got the front court size with Zach Edey to throw at UNC that UNC maybe doesn't see in a lot of other places. So I don't know. UNC, at this point, I think they're just tinkering with things, figuring it out, figuring out a lineup and a rotation, and sort of settling into the defensive scheme. But I think ultimately the personnel is so good that I think eventually they're going to figure it out. They'll tighten the rotation. This is going to turn into being a pretty good team this year.
Oh, I have every confidence that North Carolina is going to be good. I guess worrying about maybe how good they'll be defensively is
yes,
fair.
For sure.
My guess is that whenever you play Purdue, I think the game just kind of gets boring. That's the way Purdue. So I might just kind of watch that with one eye closed. Let me ask you very quickly about the Blue Devils. Watching the first game, the only thing that really concerned me was perimeter shooting. They only made one against Kentucky. It's hard to judge against other teams when they play lesser competition like Army or Gardner Webb. Basically, is their perimeter game, is it that going to come down to how much Joey Baker plays and develops Wendell Moore? It doesn't seem like they have reliable shooting beyond that.
Yeah, it's tough to tell at this point because they've shot it. They shot it pretty well in the exhibition game against Winston-Salem State, and they've shot it better since the Kentucky game. But certainly, like, there's no, like, you know, Gary Trent Jr., Grayson Allen, you know, perimeter, you know, spot up bomber on this roster. But Trevor Keels is a really good shooter, like a beautiful shot, gets it off in a flash. I think that you get enough, if you can squeeze enough out of Wendell Moore Jr. as a shooter, Roach can be okay from deep. Like, I think they can hit it just in, and obviously, Joey Baker is the spot up weapon, and he's had a couple nice games for them recently, including some of these small ball lineups in the Army game. But I think they can shoot it just well enough, right? And one of the other ways for them to really get to some of those lineups is to play Banchero at five, you know, take Williams and John off the court. I know they don't want to do this. They did it against Army, and they'll probably do it more this season. But that lineup allows you to really, like, maximize. I thought they had some really good spacing in the Army game around Banchero. That way you can get at least five guys on the court that are willing to shoot a three, including, you know, Banchero. And four of those guys are at least, you know, fairly credible three-point shooters. So I'm not too worried about it. And then I do think, like, I mean, again, I'm actually writing something about this right now, which should be up at accsports.com later this afternoon. But just – like the AJ Griffin flashes against Gardner Webb, man, made you, you just want this guy to be healthy and have a long, incredibly successful NBA career. That's like most important, but just knowing how good this guy is and how physically gifted he is with that shot, that beautiful soft jumper of his. And he had a couple plays in the second half against Gardner Webb that just make you think, like, wow, if this guy could get to being 80%, 90% health, whatever it is this year, man, I mean, who has better personnel than this roster, you know, than Duke? Like, they've got elite NBA type caliber pieces on this crew. And I just hope we get to see a lineup at some point this year of Wendell Moore, Jeremy Roach, Trevor Keels, AJ Griffin, and Paolo Banchero. Like, I really, really would like to see that at some point. And look, I was at that game at Cameron the other night. You could see Duke staff on the bench, like, trying to contain themselves when AJ Griffin made a big play. Right. So you can tell, like, they want it for him. Everybody wants it for him. And that's just the ultimate wild card. It's like, if Griffin gets healthy, he's, like, you know, outside of Banchero, he's the second most talented player in the league. It's just like, do we get to see it? That's the big question, I guess.
I just want an ISO cam on Trevor Keels. That's all I care
about.
He's
awesome.
I love everything about him.
He's incredible. Yep. He's incredible. I love watching him play. The guy can get his own shot. He can shoot off the, like, he doesn't need the ball to be a great offensive player, but man, he can get his own look, get into the lane, get downhill. Just a tremendous perimeter offensive player.
Yeah, and I love his defense too. Brian Geisinger, appreciate your time. We'll talk again soon.
Sounds good, guys.
And with us now is John Feinstein. Some people call you an author and a sports writer. I think it's more accurate to call you a storyteller. Is that okay?
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I think that's what I've done for most of my career. I always say to people that while my books are about people who are in sports, they're more about people than sports. The people just happen to be involved in sports, and I'm trying to tell stories about those people. And obviously, I know you've read it. That's what I was trying to do in this book, but just in a very different way than I've done in the past.
The book is called Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, Race and the Illusion of Progress in Modern Sports. I'm glad that you put illusion of progress because I think people are under the impression that we have made great progress, but it's clear that we have not. And I'm always fascinated by the relationships that you have. And John Thompson, I'm not sure he'd be flattered just now.
He called me.
But John Thompson, when you told him that you were going to write this, he said, you have to write it.
Yes.
And I know what he meant by that. But I would like you to talk about why he said that to you.
Well, John and I had a fascinating relationship, I think you can say, for close to 40 years. We fought like cats when I was covering his Georgetown teams for the Washington Post because John didn't want to give anybody any access.
Right.
And my job was to get access. And we fought about that. But as we both got older, and as he got out of coaching, probably not coincidentally, we first became friendly after I wrote the Red Auerbach book because he loved Red so much and he loved the book. And then friends, and I was a regular on his radio show. And then he became really a mentor to me because he was so damn smart, Adam. And I know he intimidated a lot of people with his size and with the things that he said, but he was really smart. And when I first felt like I needed to write this book, during the anthem protests of 2017, when I was in an NFL stadium every week, I went to see him and I said, I want to write a book about race in sports because I think it's a huge issue in our country, race in general.
Yes.
And he looked at me and the first thing he said was, you might as well try to explain the Holy Trinity. And he was right. I mean, to try to explain the whole thing would be impossible, and I did not attempt to, you know, write a 10-part book series on the subject. But then he pointed his finger at me and he said, which is why you have to do it. And what he meant by that was, A, it was important, and B, it needed a white guy to do it.
Yes.
Now, there might very well be people who say, wait a minute, how can you write about race in sports when you're, you know, and the problems that black people have when you're white? Well, the answer to that is I've written about college basketball coaches for years, and I was never a college basketball coach. And I've written about professional golf for years, and God knows I was never a professional golfer. But I talk to people, have talked to people, who were basketball coaches, great ones, not so great ones, same thing with golfers. And in this book, I talked to about 100 different guys across all walks of life in sports, dating back to Tommy Smith and John Carlos, and then coming up to the present time to guys like Mike Tomlin and Patrick Mahomes and Eric Bieniemy, about what it is like to be black. And the most interesting, people always ask me when I write about what surprised you? And things don't usually surprise me. I usually have a pretty good idea of what I'm going to get when I start researching a book. But this time I was surprised because my first notion was that our country has never been more polarized racially than today. Or in back in 2017, when President Trump was ranting about, you know, fire all the SOBs, right, quote unquote, who were kneeling for the anthem and fans were booing. You know, it was 90% white fans booing 90% black players because there were some white players who knelt.
Sure.
And but what I found as I started the research and started talking to people in detail was to say that our country is polarized racially. It's like saying today's Thursday. It's unfortunately, it's a given. And there will be people who won't even open this book because they'll say, oh, well, you know, we don't have racial problems. We don't have Jim Crow anymore. You know, there's all sorts of progress that's been made, which there has been, without any doubt. But the book really became, as I did my reporting, about the fact that here we are in 2021, and we've made progress, but we still got a long way to go. And the only way we're going to make more progress is for people to acknowledge that fact.
Yeah. I also early part, I think it might have even been in the intro, George Raveling, longtime and very influential basketball coach, college basketball coach, basically laughed and said, you'll never understand. You can do all the research, and I believe he supported what you were doing, but he goes, you'll never understand what it's like to be black. And I know you related a story with Mike Tomlin. I'm going to talk about Mike Tomlin in a second. John Feinstein is joining us. He's on Twitter @JFeinsteinBooks. Go give him a follow. You know, you talk about the protests, and we talked about this during, as it was happening in real time, and that year, it almost seemed like, well, the protests weren't going to stop. And I'm not saying they should have. They were not going to stop. But it seemed like in order to make the anger stop, we had to gentrify the protest. So we had to kneel before the anthem.
Right.
And then stand up during the anthem, and kneeling before the anthem really angered people. And then you saw people like Drew Brees and Jerry Jones. And to me, that was just, it was just sort of making it more palatable for white America to deal with the reality of the racial problems.
Yeah. And go back again to 2017. When the anthem protests in the NFL had become a big thing. Colin Kaepernick started it in 2016 and was blackballed out of the league. And anybody who says he wasn't is either racist or stupid or doesn't know anything about football. Take your pick, or all three.
Yeah.
Your point is well taken, because I was at a game in Baltimore the week after Trump's Fire the SOBs rant in Alabama.
Right.
And the Ravens, as a team, had gotten together and said, okay, we're all going to kneel, black players, white players, before the anthem. And then we'll stand up and hold hands during the anthem. And I'm telling you, Adam, almost everybody in that stadium, most of them white, booed the hell out of them.
Yep.
And they were standing during the anthem. And it was as if people, and these are the people I'm talking about, who don't want to acknowledge that we still have a problem. I remember seeing somebody, surprisingly enough, on Fox saying, how can these men be complaining when they make millions of dollars? Well, that, of course, misses the entire point.
Right.
Well, it has nothing to do with making millions of dollars or not making millions of dollars. And that's why I wanted to talk to all the different people I talked to, because I wanted to say, is this overdone? Tell me if it is. And honestly, Adam, I didn't interview one black person who had not at some point been stopped for DWB, driving while black. And Steve Kerr made a great point to me. He said, when I get in my car, if I get pulled over by a cop, it's almost certainly for a legitimate reason. And I'm going to be upset about getting a ticket or whatever, but I don't fear for my life. But if you're black, especially at night, and you get pulled over and you've done nothing wrong, and the first question almost inevitably is, where did you get this car? As in, you're black and you're driving a nice car. So something must be wrong here. One of the stories Doc Rivers told me was when he was playing in Los Angeles for the Clippers, and they were still playing in the old sports arena, and you basically had to drive through South Central to get to the arena. And he said, you know, every other week he'd get stopped. Where'd you get this car? And one of his teammates, Kenny Norman, who you probably remember, made the mistake of stopping for gas one day en route to the arena. And the next thing he knew, a police car had pulled over and he'd been thrown across the hood of the car and handcuffed because the car had to be stolen. And, you know, those are things, that's what George meant when he said, you can't understand what it's like to walk in a black man's shoes. I can't. And I wouldn't think for a second that I can, but I can talk to people who can explain it to me, and that's what I tried to do in the book.
Yeah, we listen, we hear coded language. And by the way, we hear coded language towards white players too. I'm watching a Giants game, and people will tell me, you know, Daniel Jones is sneaky athletic. Like, right. No, he's a phenomenal athlete, and anybody that has watched him play would understand that he is a phenomenal athlete. I get it. He's white. We can't process a white player possibly being a great athlete because that's hard for a lot of people.
Right. Well, white players are always cerebral and they're, you know, they play like coaches on the basketball court and high IQ.
Gym rats.
IQ.
They're all gym
black
rats.
Black guys can jump out of the gym.
So here's Terry Bradshaw on Fox's NFL pregame show, who's obviously no fan of Mike Tomlin. For whatever reason, he's not a fan of Mike Tomlin.
Right.
Calls Mike Tomlin to say he's a player's coach. He's a rah-rah guy. Like, you couldn't be more wrong about Mike Tomlin, A, as some sort of a player's coach, as though he's lenient with players. He's right. Not. And Mike Tomlin will never get credit as being a brilliant coach, just like there are zero up-and-coming, bright young coaching minds who also happen to be black.
Yeah, and I, as you can tell reading the book, I spent a lot of time talking to Mike Tomlin.
Yes.
And he's one of the bright guys I've known in sports. I mean, he's very thoughtful. He has a lot of thoughts about how he grew up and what it was like. And he's well aware of what you just said. His record is already better than Bill Cowher's.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Cowher's in the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
Now, there's no way, to me, Tomlin is not going to be a Hall of Fame coach. If he's not, something's wrong with the voting system. And, you know, he got the job with the Steelers at 36. Why? Because he blew the Rooneys away in the interview. Yeah. They were basically interviewing him because of the ironically named Rooney Rule. and they said, wait a minute, this guy's terrific.
Yep.
He's never had a losing season. He's you know, you talk about him, players coach. Talk to his players. I mean, they love him, but he's tough as hell.
Yep.
On them to get them to play better. And it, again, I don't think Terry Bradshaw, I mean, he does. Let's put aside the personality issue because that's clearly there. But I don't think Terry Bradshaw is sitting there saying, I don't like this guy because he's black.
I agree.
But I do think, like all of us, he's a product of his upbringing. And your point about the young coaches, I mean, Tony Dungy, who is hardly a jump up on a table and shout guy.
Right.
He's just the opposite. But he says two of the last 20 hires, head coaching hires in the NFL, have been black. How is that possible? How is that possible? And, you know, both coordinators in Tampa last year were black and, mm-hmm. and clearly did great jobs. And by the way, you know, how have the Jets been in the last few years since the firing? And and then the prime example, of course, is Eric Bieniemy, who's only coached the best offense in football for the last 3 years and the best quarterback in football, who was drafted. Let's remember, Patrick Mahomes was drafted with the 10th pick in the NFL draft. And who went second that year in the NFL draft?
Yes, Mitch Trubisky.
Who you are very familiar with. And
oh, man.
It's funny because I asked Doug Williams, because that was the year I was doing my quarterback book. I said to him, where would Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, who was drafted 12th, have gone if they'd been white? And he said, well, they'd have gone ahead of Trubisky. I said, Trubisky went number two. And he said, exactly.
Yep.
And when I ran that line past Tony Dungy, he said, you asked the question wrong. The question you should have asked was, where would Trubisky have been drafted if he'd been black? And I think that, and again, I'm not saying Ryan Pace sat there and said, we're not going to draft a black quarterback. But there are stereotypes that are in the minds mm-hmm. still of people in sports. And there's no better example than Lamar Jackson. Do you think anybody with his skill set who was white would have had scouts and TV guys saying, oh, he needs to change positions, he needs to be a wide receiver or running back?
He would have been the first pick in the draft by a mile.
And clearly that would have been the right thing to do.
Yeah. There's no question about it.
And it took a black general manager to take him.
That's true.
Ozzie Newsome.
And for a long time, Ozzie Smith wasn't even in name the general manager. He had to ascend to that position.
Ozzie Newsome won a Super Bowl running the Ravens before he was named general manager.
He's arguably the best general manager of the last quarter century. I think he's tremendous.
Take a look at his first draft. He drafted Jonathan Ogden over the objections of his owner, who wanted to draft Lawrence Phillips, and we all know how Lawrence Phillips turned out.
Yep.
And then late in the first round, he had a second pick. He took a linebacker who was too small in the eyes of most scouts out of Miami named Ray Lewis.
Yep, that's a pretty good first round. That's a pretty good first round. All right, we're gonna have to you're gonna have to come back because I want to ask you other questions that we don't have time for today. John Feinstein, the book is Raise a Fist, Take a Knee. It's absolutely awesome. I know you've called it maybe the most important book or the most fun book you had.
Not the most fun book. A lot of the guys I talked to, Adam, I know you got to go, but were guys I didn't know. And,
right.
and fortunately, people connected me to them. I mean, I'll just tell you, Ozzie Newsome got me to James Harris. James Harris got me to Marlon Briscoe. Marlon Briscoe got me to John Carlos. So that's how the book worked in many ways. But, and it's a difficult subject. And I knew it was going to be, the book was going to be controversial. I understand that. But I do believe it's the most important book I've ever written because of the subject matter.
It's outstanding. Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, John Feinstein on Twitter, at J Feinstein Books. Thank you very much. We will talk again soon because I want to talk to you about Rory and sports commissioners.
Sounds good.
All right, John,
by
thank you.
By the way, the only commissioner who wouldn't talk to me for the book was Goodell.
That's unfortunate.
Because
I also, I think in his heart, I think he wants things to be different. I just don't think he knows.
And you know what?
Knows how to go about it.
I know we got to go, but Mike Tomlin and Tony Dungy, both of whom I have great respect for, said the exact same thing.
Sally Jenkins believes
it. He wants to do the right thing.
Sally Jenkins believes that Roger wants to do the right thing, and he just can't bring himself to do it ever.
He's getting paid $44 million to do what the owners want.
I don't know. $44 million buys a lot. John, you're the best. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Adam.
You've been listening to the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000. Don't forget, this podcast drops every weekday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app, or you can subscribe for free at the iTunes and Google Play stores.